stopping male violence, education budget we have to have good news about big batteries. This is the Week on Wednesday.
On Monday.
Hello, welcome to the Week on Wednesday, recorded on a Monday. These illnesses have been knocking us around no end. My name is Ben Davison, I think, still.
Still Ben Davison, darling, promise.
as you can tell, I've been off air, on and off air because of illness. I am joined, as always, by the great, the glorious, the one and only best-selling author and sellout playwright of Banging Denmark and Fool in Love and Animal Farm and some projects yet to come, as well as, of course, a musical that's coming to Australia this June. July. See, look, my brain is all over the shop. You're just going to have to bear with me, listeners.
Yeah, no, Animal Farm in London, June.
There you go. So if you're in London, you've got two bites of cherry there. South Australia, you can catch The Questions, a musical by Van Badham and her collaborator, Richard
Wise. He's good. Ben is all right.
All right. Look, today, of course, if you've been following us on social media, you'll have seen Van published an article in The Guardian yesterday, about the scourge of male violence and violence against women in this country. It's been a hot topic of conversation because so many were dying at the hands of men, and of course, the tragedy that unfolded at the shopping center in Bondi. The whole nation is reeling about how to deal with this. There was a big announcement by the federal government of $5,000 being made available to fleeing from family violence. There's interesting reactions to some of this stuff, Van, but, you know, really, really keen to get your thoughts. Obviously, from my perspective, just quickly, as someone who has experienced violence, it is horrendous to be the victim of violence. And that's as a man. I can barely imagine what it would be like to experience violence at half size and half my weight, from who was double my size and double my weight, and someone who I had trusted and perhaps lived with and perhaps had told me that they loved me.
Well, statistically, the most dangerous place for women is in the home. And that I was making in my piece that, I mean, it is so hard to face the policy of stopping violence against women, which is what we want. We want violence against to stop. We want violence against children stop. We know that in family violence situations, children targeted by perpetrators, or women manipulated by perpetrators because of their children, or their children see violence. I mean, it's so horrendous. And for people who have not had the experience of being raised in violent homes or have been subject to violence, it's almost impossible to get your head around what makes a perpetrator, why do people do this? And we know what makes a perpetrator, and we know what informs their behaviour. There was a study recently that was like, perpetrators use violence to get what they want. They to control, they want to to have service from their past in various ways get their houses cleaned or their clothes washed or their meals prepared or sex applied to them. They get off on feelings of power and control, deeply misogynistic. They have values that hold that women are inferior. They big themselves up by pursuing violence as a means of exerting a form of physical domination. We know that that in terms of violence, somebody who is raised with values to believe that women are inferior and subordinate and not subjectivities, not but objects, that people with those values are more likely to violence against women, as you can imagine. And the reality is that the experience for who are subject to violence is different. There are in every single case is an individual case. The way violence happens, the way that control is pursued, there are the inventiveness of perpetrators in terms of the way that they hurt and control were extraordinary, the locations in which they exert violence, infinite. There was an extraordinary piece that came out last week, Leavitt's and Wendy Toy piece, that was in the Fairfax Nine papers about how there is a new industry opening of like evidence gatherers and surveillance investigators, people who are employed to sweep women's homes for tracking devices, bugs,
oh, wow,
and cameras that are used by perpetrators to coerce, control a target and harass them. So a team comes to your house. And the piece talked about women who had left violent relationships,
yeah,
with controlling, coercive partners, former partners, and these women found AirTags used in their cars to track their movements, you know, there's some listening devices placed around the home,
yeah,
spyware inserted on their phones to track their movements. The most extraordinary one was using fridges to track women in the home, to record them, to communicate with them, to send violent messages. And I have a complex and sad backstory in life. I have been in a violent relationship many, many years ago, which very fortunately I got out of very quickly. But I have had experience that are pretty brutal, pretty horrendous. And I was reading the one about the smart fridges as like, even I was just stunned. It's the inventiveness and it's the performance of cruelty that is just relentless. Like the idea that some would say, I'm leaving you, like they say it directly, or whether they just get out to get away from the relationship. And so he's so obsessed with the control that they exert over another person that they would track their car or install spyware on where on their phone or monitor them from a fridge.
Mm.
This is what we're up against. And policy conversations are really difficult in this area because they are in every violent relationship has its own spheres and
methods
and nuances, and there's no, if there was one size fits all to end the epidemic, we would be,
because that's the sort of logical next question, isn't it, Van? Like when we're confronted with these deaths and we're confronted with these unacceptable numbers of violence, and we see it infiltrating the culture and into the areas of young people, which we'll talk about shortly, the question that comes up is, well, what do we do? How do we stop it? You know, and obviously the federal government has, you know, held a national cabinet meeting and they've laid out some ways to begin to, you know, those are good. There's funding there. There's money for support organizations. There's, you know, all these, the paid domestic violence leave, which the union movement, you know, struggled for so long. And if you're not a member of your union, then you really should be, because I mean, the union movement's been at the forefront of understanding this as a workplace as well. You go to Australian unions and unions.au/wow to join your union. But, you know, we keep, but it's almost like you sort of catch the thing, and then, as you say, oh, now they're using smart fridges. So how do we get in front of this? How do we?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. I was writing my article. I did an interview with advocates from the incest and family violence community, and can I just say, the bravery, the absolute, the empathy, generosity of people who've had those experiences in talking about them and being advocates for something that's so horrendously awful, such a cruelty of women and children, that it's just amazing.
Mm.
It's hard to talk about.
Yeah.
But the statistics that I was given in those interviews was that we know that 1 in 100 children in the school system are subject to sexual abuse within the family, and that's now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I know from statistics and the Royal Commissions into Family Violence and institutional sexual abuse, like the institution that where the most sexual abuse takes place is the family home, and the heteronormative patriarchy. And 51% of people who are grow up in violent, abusive homes become victims of violence and abuse as adults, 51%. So recommendations from Royal Commission.
So they become victims. So when they're victim children, and then they're victims as adults.
And what advocates were saying to me was that you don't know what you don't know. If you're raised in a family of violence and exploitation and abuse from people who society tells you love and protect you, of course it's more likely that those kind of elements of relationship are something that you understand when you become older, and that love of protection or family or partnership is understood in those terms, which is heartbreaking. I mean, just absolutely horrendous. Recommendations have been made about early intervention, better training to spot and identify and get children out of dangerous situations and understand what the patterns are. Use adult survivors who got through their entire school education without anyone identifying that they were being subject to violence or abuse, that you know, family interventions, training, social work support systems, they're really crucial. If we're talking about 51% of survivors going into those violent adult relationships, I mean, this is the front that we want to explore. But these are complex challenges. I was raised in a family that was beyond safe and had an idyllic, perfect childhood with absolutely no violence. And yet, as an adult, I found myself in a violent relationship and subjected to harassment and sexual assault and those things. Like, there's no one fits all. And interesting that we're now understanding just the resourcefulness of perpetrators and looking at issues around image-based abuse. When the notion of image-based abuse was broached in Australia, and it started to become a problem, it was broached in terms of revenge porn. Yeah. The idea that you would be in a loving sexual relationship, that, you know, you fool around with cameras, film yourself, make homemade porn. This is a framework that people understood revenge, and then you break up and then jilted ex
posts videos. Online, That's not the reality.
That's not the main game.
Yeah.
Image based in Australia is used in abusive relationships where overwhelmingly female partners subject to sexually humiliating, and this is recorded, and the footage is used as a means of blackmail and control of those women by the perpetrator in relationships, with the threat of that material being sent to partners, their families, their friends,
their workplaces, in
their
some
workplaces. You know, that it's another form of controlling behaviour and family or intimate partner abuse, and it's getting people's heads around just how horrendous this is.
Mm.
You know, and my view for people, it becomes difficult to talk about because it's so disgraceful and hurtful and cruel and lasting and infinitely variable. I mean, I was reading articles on the weekend about women who were in sexual coercive relationships who took years to understand that what was happening to them was actually rape.
Yeah.
That feeling that they were bullied into performing acts that they found painful and unenjoyable, if that they had to, that there was some kind of coercion within their relationship, didn't have the right to say no to their husband or boyfriend or sexual partner around acts that they found physically innocent and painful. It is absolutely extraordinary. And of course, the psychology of survival kicks in with people that if you just say yes, if you just go through with it, if you just, you know, placate or please or engage, that you'll have 9 minutes of not being punched in the face or ripped apart or stalked or harassed or, you know, this is complex and deep and horrendous stuff. And we've got to get out of just the stranger danger model or sensationalize and reduce things to revenge porn and have a broader conversation about the willingness of a significant community. The idea that your K to six primary school has 4, 5, 6 children who are being sexually abused by a member. These are the statistics that we did.
It's fairly extraordinary. And I think today there's been some more revelations about in school boys rape girls and sharing like pretty disgusting comments about girls' bodies and girls' faces. And I think the Premier Victor come out and condemned it. You know, it is a real cultural issue here, right? Like as you say, there are
a group of boys from a private school, and I think this is really worth understanding, okay, is that stereotypes of who is and isn't abused, you know, this idea that violence against women is a poverty crime.
Yeah.
Is not true.
Yeah, not true.
In fact, there's an insulation for perpetrators in wealthy and privileged communities.
Yeah.
There's a lot of financial abuse and coercion that goes on, particularly in wards. I remember having a conversation with a women's anti-violence activist who was a Tory woman, like a conservative woman, who told me that it was her number one political issue because of the number of women she in extremely privileged, seemingly privileged circumstances, materially privileged circumstances in the fancy eastern suburbs of Melbourne, that there was a nickname called Toorak Sleeves. And it was when women who were being subjected to violence, to hide bruises in those communities, would be wearing long sleeves to
even
on a warm day. And like the brutality is unfathomable, and had partners who would control them financially, who would, you know, essentially their assets, control their credit cards, their ability to purchase any, their own ability to physically get out of violent situations, using forms of social coercion and coercive control. Like it's everywhere.
Mm.
And of course, today the news is that it's from Yarra Valley Grammar, which is co-ed private school.
Mm.
So these are not. It's not, you know, an impoverished community.
Yeah.
This is not a working class community. This is a private grammar school. Created a spreadsheet where the boys were rating the girls as whether they were wifey or cuties. And there was one category. I can say the word because it is so terrible, unrapeable. So you have boys from a middle class community whose parents have the means of sending them a private school, who have gotten together and decided the girls who they attend school with, they attend class with, the girls who they know who are part of their community on their sexual attractives and their rapability. And say, I get called unrapable on the internet all the time by men, and I just want to point out that's actually not true. I wish it was.
It is unacceptable. You know, as a man, I find it just disgraceful, absolutely disgraceful. And when I was growing up, there was this sense of, oh, boys will be boys and they'll grow out of it and all this sort of stuff. Well, they don't grow out of it.
No,
I mean, this is the thing. This is the thing that we have to accept is if we allow that kind of behavior to normalize, you know, not every boy who participated in that activity will end up committing violence against women, but every person who committed violence against, who comes to commit violence against women from that school will have participated in that activity.
Yeah.
And, you know, those sort of markers need to be absolutely laid down and interventions put in place because it shouldn't be happening. Should not be happening in any schools. you know, we're going to talk about education shortly and why education is so important, but this is obviously, you know, there is this undercurrent, and the reason why we need schools to have buses is to stop this. And part of the reason why I think private schools, frankly, are doing a disservice to the community is because there is almost a sense of business community, they realize, right, is that high-performing people who are toxic culturally actually really bad. They're not high performers. They destroy communities. They destroy organizations. They destroy school communities. And in cases like this, they can physically destroy other people.
The girls at that school are getting counseling. Can you imagine what it's like being a 15-year-old girl and finding your name on a list where you are described by your peers, by the people who you see every day, as unrape? Like, that's
it's
psychologically cruel. Yeah. And that's to a child. And it doesn't matter that the perpetrators are other children.
Yeah.
You know, and the idea that you would pay money to an institution that allowed your child to be subject to that kind of bullying is extraordinary. And Chantelle Contos, who's the you know, women and girls advocate who came through the private school system in Australia and who became an advocate who released all of that information a few years ago about, you know, there was a survey experience of girls in private schools, the way that they were objectified and, you know, the way that this sort of this, you know, the institutional values of social entitlement, which is the whole why private schools exist, you know, this sense of superiority or, you know, enclavism that, you know, those other people are out there. But you went to private school, you heard the propaganda, better, you're the leaders of tomorrow, you're superior, you know, people like me are just peasants and, you know, not worth thinking about.
To be fair, we were never told people like you were peasants.
I mean,
we never got the word. We were certainly indoctrinated with a sense of, you know, class of two, we're the leaders of tomorrow. You know, you have a responsibility to lead. You have a responsibility, you know, to your community. At the same time, when things, you know, went wrong that could embarrass the school, there was always, and I'm not going to go into details here now, but there was always efforts made by school administration, sure that the general public was not made aware. Often parents were variations of a story rather than things that we as students knew had happened in a different way. Like it was a very, it is very, say, an enclave. In some of these institutions, of attitude.
I mean, that's what you're paying for. That's the point.
And it is, you know, and I say cults because of course we know as well, very much into the way that all of the things you've just described about control, objectification of women, preventing women from having decision-making over their own bodies,
it's all about the dynamics of...
Yeah.
And that's that study that came out where they interviewed perpetrators who were like, yeah, I use violence to get what I want. Oh, okay. And this is the thing about that whole incident. I mean, and the horror expressed by the Premier of Victoria, Jacinta Allan, who described it as disgusting, you know, because what we also know is that the stereotype that, feminists think all men are rapists. That's not true.
No.
Jim, who thinks all men are rapists. And the kids who are participating in that activity and being those female children on their sexual attractiveness, you know, whether they're rapable or not, the kid who's in that community who is statistically likely to be rapist is using the participation of all those to justify their own behaviour, believing that what they will go on to do is entirely justified, that other boys caught it, and this is boys will be boys. And anybody who makes around this is paying the conviction in either today or tomorrow's perpetrator. And for people who are like, oh, well, you know, kids are testing boundaries and, you know, blah, blah, blah. They've always been like this. It's like, well, Yeah, we know, because we know the history of violence against women. We know about the number of women and children who, in fact, it's massively unreported, too. And if we want to stop it, we have to stop with the traditional excuses and the traditional facilitations. I'm glad that school has suspended the kids who participated in this activity, but are they bringing in the social workers? Like, will there be interventions to find out, you know, who is the danger to the community and how much at risk, you know, the girls around them are?
Yeah, it is extraordinary. It is extraordinarily complex. I think that's part of what does people's head in, as we were saying before, is that there's no one-size-fits-all model. It's really an evolving cultural phenomenon. We have to continually and wrestle with, you know, as technology changes, as the opportunities for people who want to commit these sorts of crimes evolve, so too do our laws, our regulations, the way that we observe and the way that we discover how they're committing these crimes has to evolve as well.
And no one wants to believe it. I mean, this is the thing too. And people, we've all been in those conversations where somebody's behaviour discussed as inappropriate or dangerous or just completely unacceptable, and wanted if that it wasn't true, because the social implications of identifying who is dangerous are really tricky. And we don't actually have... We don't actually have resources around that. Like, I remember being a young woman and being told by a friend who I had thought was a friend, a guy, had behaved with her in an extremely inappropriate way. And I didn't want to believe it.
No.
You know, I didn't want to believe that someone in my circle who'd been in my house, who'd eaten meals with my family, had put her in a position where she was physically afraid of his behavior, and it took an intellectual test to go, there is absolutely no way that she is lying to me.
Yeah.
And he has done this, and saying, are you going to report it? You're going to take it to the police? And her going, what's the point? And I just ended all contact with him, because I didn't know as a young person, well, what was my responsibility? She does, like, it's constant. Mm. And we've got to work out as a society how we handle reporting, and who do we report to, and at what point do you become concerned? At what point do you go, this high school were participating in this activity?
Mm.
What does that indicate? And who is the likely perpetrator? And what does an intervention like? How do we keep these girls safe? How do we ensure that there are effective social punishments and this behavior? You know, and it's certainly that thing. It's really difficult. Where do you intervene? And when do you intervene? Mm. And who do you report to? And more training is needed in the workplace, at the schools. Family intervention is so important.
Mm. It's interesting because, you know, I remember growing up the debate about, you know, should teachers have to be able, you know, be forced to report if they suspected violence, and what would that mean and all the rest of it. Now, of course, that's just a given. You know, if a child bruises on their face, teachers will do that. But as we're just discussing, it's evolving. It's more insidious now. Sometimes it's actually harder to identify and you know, where you are the kind of third party or the outsider, how do you support, where do you intervene in, where I think a lot of us wrestle with. And obviously the key thing is to support the victim survivors in any way we can. And I mean, that seems to be the track that the Commonwealth is going down by saying, look, we facilitate victim survivors to not be at least financially. So we'll remove that we can at least deal with that. We know that's a sort of, if you like, low hanging fruit for a government to be able to go, you have no financial barrier to stop you from getting away. Now, some of these other barriers are much more complex, and how government can or can't be really telling over the coming years, I think. But it's not an issue going away. It has gotten worse in the last few years. You know, people say COVID made it worse too. You know, there's so much of people, so much time together, and now there's just a explosion in post cabin fever.
Well, I mean, I think part of it, so more than even cabin fever, being trapped with one another and dynamics of relationships becoming coercive or abusive, it's also lack of social engagement and vision. One of the things that we know, and the work that I have done as capacities in the anti-gendered violence policy area, is that the women have got the best chance out in making it. I mean, which just sounds so horrendous to have to say, are women with highly developed social networks.
Yeah.
Like, the more we can physically see one another, and the more agencies, individuals we connect with, they call effects.
Mm-hmm.
And the network effects of having a very strong social community, having really good friends, having engaged members, being part of a community that can see you.
Active in your union.
Active in your union, you know, active in your parents and students group, you know, active with your local dog show. It doesn't matter. Active in your network. Of course, perpetrators know this, which the habit of perpetrators to socially marginalize, isolate, gaslight, tell women, you know, make women paranoid about their relationships, alienate their friends, threaten their friends, alienate their family members, physically relocate women from communities where they're well known. And it's so complicated. I wrote an article years ago about the actual urban design of new housing developments in the suburbs and communities that encourage facilitate perpetrators by putting women in a position where if they don't have access to their own car,
they can't go anywhere.
They shop. They can't, you know,
go. They can't leave.
They can't go see a lawyer. They can't leave. They can't access police services. Then they're not.
Yeah.
They're physically not seen by people. And if a perpetrator is taking control of a vehicle, where can those women go? I mean, there are housing developments near us that look like that. Your shop or a shared space mile.
Yeah. And you wouldn't know how many people even live in the house.
You wouldn't know how many people live in the house or who they were. And this is what we're up against. And when perpetrators are so absolutely relentlessly obsessed with what they get out of perpetuating coercion, control and violence, they are willing to install bugs in your car or stalk you through your fridge.
Yeah.
Like, the policy imagination ride is enormous.
Yeah. Well, look, that's, you know, this is obviously an issue that's not, unfortunately, not going away anytime soon. Hopefully things will improve. You know, all I can say is thank you to those doing the work. There are so many frontline workers who are working with victim survivors, who are facilitating groups of victim survivors, who are trying to have the policy imagination to counter the inventiveness, if you're of these perpetrators. It's incredibly important work that those workers are doing. It's undervalued as well, absolutely undervalued. I know that from talking to people in the union movement who are in these spaces. And I think more and more we're going to see focus on how do we resource this? How do we come up with the policy solutions? And we think about it holistically, as you said, Van, urban design, you know, I can dollars to donuts. Most of the people listening to the podcast, myself included, would not have gone, oh, urban design is actually a factor in the perpetrators to commit family violence. You know, that's.
Oh, and it's the image based abuse thing and not. Yeah. And not conceiving of in family violence.
Yeah.
And, you know, and complex strands of institutional engagement and abuse and marginalization, all of these things. And I apologize if I've spoken inelegantly. And obviously, like a wonderful relationship, and I've been safe for a very long time.
Mm. I'm glad you feel.
Yeah, of course I do. Yeah. And you're awesome. I picked you for a reason.
You're like, awesome too.
But it's exciting, and you never forget.
No,
you never forget what it to be frightened.
No.
And vulnerable. Even in my case, you know, I've been very safe for a very, very long time. And I just like to particularly thank the incest advocates, who the anti-incest advocates, incest victim survivors, who briefed me for my piece this week. And my MU is overwhelming. You know, you're amazing. And willingness, if we're willing to confront this issue as a society, we have to face things that frighten us, and we have to face the fact that the family is an unsafe place for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of that, it was recognised during the pandemic, actually, was that family home was an unsafe place for a lot of people, a lot of children. And people might remember that while schools were generally closed, they were in fact open to those students who were considered at risk or who needed to not be home because it was not safe. Using this to segue into the fact that education is such a key part of Australian culture, not just for what it does for building up citizens to be productive workers and members of society, and how the role it can play in the development of individuals, it's likely to be a big part of the forthcoming federal budget, Fan. Now, I know this might feel like a hard way to go from that topic to this, but part of the reason I'm raising it is that we know that in public schools, 98% of our public school are underfunded. People say, well, you know, they've got teachers. Yes, maybe the classrooms are big, or it's a bit difficult sometimes, and those, and if the student better behaved. Well, some of that funding that's not being provided means, of course, it's harder to see them. It means there aren't student officers available in a lot of schools. It means there aren't teaching assistants available in a lot of schools. It does mean that some schools don't have a consistent teacher who will be able to see patterns and trends in a student's behaviour that might indicate there are problems. These are practices that, when you think about
record commissions addressing violence,
that so these minimum funding guidelines that have been around now for a decade need to be put in place. And you know, I'm all for some of the stuff the government has done, the federal government has done already. You know, this week we've seen a couple of big announcements. $3 billion that will help three people who have help debts. That's great. We're big believers here in it. You know, higher education. You know, in addition to that, is $319.50 a week for people who are doing teaching, nursing, and social work practical placements. You know, as someone who didn't an international major as part of his degree, couldn't afford to take an unpaid international placement. Now, I know international placements are not in this package, but the idea that we would ask people who want to be nurses and teachers and social workers to do unpaid practical placements and basically give up their work for 2 or 3 weeks and expect them to somehow pay the rent. Of course, now the government is taking steps to fix that, which is great. That's thousands. I think they're talking about 650,000 people will benefit from that program every year. This is what we need. This is what we need. Up our numbers of teachers, our nurses, our social workers who can help us deal with some of these social crisis issues. They've announced $1,000 grants for new energy apprenticeships, installing solar panels, working on big batteries, electric vehicles, and get these investments in the future. And, you know, Van, I don't know if you know this, but for all of the last government, there was no infrastructure funds available for public schools from the Commonwealth.
You don't have to say the word peasants aloud to mean it.
Yeah, that's right.
They just laid around it.
So the JCLAIR has been making these announcements one at a time, 68 million New South Wales, 17 million for South Australia, 25 million for WA, 48 million for Victoria. And I'm going to guess, not so much of a political cynic, but given the state election in Queensland is later this year, there's a good chance their fund will be announced in the budget coming up shortly as well. And of course, you can hear Germ here expressing his concern. And of course, the regional study hubs. I didn't really know what these were. I had to sort of look into this a bit more because, you know, they made this big announcement, 10 new regional study hubs for regional university students, many of whom study distant. And I sort of thought, oh, was this just like a co-working space, you know, in a town? But no, these are like in East Arnhem Land and, you know, the Pilbara and East Gippsland, you know, Cowra, Mudgee, Innisfail, Warwick, places that are generally quite
remote,
so that they have resources. Now, these are all good announcements. I think we've talked before about the government needing a narrative. I think this is the education budget we have to have.
Oh, we absolutely need to do it. We need to invest in the nation's brains.
You know, it's $6 billion. Now people go, oh, that's a lot of money. Well, let me tell you, it's been announced that there'll be an extra $25 billion in revenue in the budget than was forecast in December. You know, and in December, about $60 billion more than was forecast the previous June. In Australia, we are in a really great economic spot. The economic management has meant that we have low levels of unemployment, which means high levels of employment. That's a double whammy impact on the budget. So there's less going out in terms of social security payments, and there's more coming in terms of tax revenue. You know, the Liberals are the highest taxing government in history. It's not as a percentage. But the reason why the dollar amounts are so high is because more people have jobs. Not only do more people have jobs, wages are going up. So yes, there is a higher tax take. But on top of that, there are, unfortunately, a number of conflicts around the world where demand for Australian resources gets driven. So if there is a war somewhere in the world, there is a higher demand for steel to make weapon rebuild or to, you know, there's a higher demand for steel, iron ore that we sell. We are the world's largest exporter of gas. Now, I'm not proud to be the world's largest exporter of gas. There's a lot of problems with that. We don't tax that properly anyway. You know,
yes, when there are restrictions on access to the gas market domestically, and yet we're the largest exporter of gas in the world.
That's a problem, and that's a state Commonwealth issue. There are some issues around that. But
obviously, let's get off fossil. That'd be fantastic. But also very thrilled with the amount of renewable infrastructure that is being instituted. Obviously, we can't do things overnight, but the progress is rapid, which is very exciting.
And that it means that there are cost savings to the budget in the long term as well. So the money is there for this to be an education budget. You know, we've seen some willingness from people like Jason Clare and Brendan O'Connor, who are the education and the training ministers respectively. To try and do this work, we really need Elbow to get on board with this. Some people, and then we listeners to this podcast, and I know Van, you knew about this too, about, you know, taking the money from private schools or whatever. And you know what? Maybe that's a good idea. But let's park that for a minute, because we don't need to do that on public schools. The money is there.
And public schools need the money now.
Yes.
And a culture war, we can have the culture war later. I don't think a single dollar of taxation revenue should be directed to private enterprises. Absolutely not. And the idea that people like me who don't have children are funding schools like the King's School and,
yeah,
you know, like just these enclaves. I find disgusting. I actually find it disgusting, and I feel it's by that. I pay tax for collective outcomes, and there is no outcome in enclave institutions.
No positive collective outcome.
No positive collective outcome in enclave entitlement institutions. There isn't. But, you know, you tackle your problems in the order that they'll kill you, and the state school system deserves to be dead to the Sudrese. Like, that's number one. And just maybe if we do that, that there will be enough parents with the confidence they should have in a system which outperforms the resources it currently has to send their children to their local state school and get them out of the dangerous enclave.
Absolutely. You know,
and have that confidence that, yeah, actually a better decision to be making in terms of social participation and all of the gains that you get from going to state school, like resilience.
Yeah.
And self-reliance, self-directed education, all of those values and the values of diversity and being educated in the values of diversity while you are there. Like, these are the things that we've got to prioritize. And it's interesting watching people kick off about the defense budget and defense spending. People are usually very surprised when they find out that lovable lefty little van here is quite pro-defense spending. And of course, I mean, we have allies at war zones. Ukraine is fighting for all of us, for all of us, to stop the Russian incursion in Europe, and a conflict that will have an expansion of that conflict. The implication of it is horrendous. You know, Russia is being supported by Iran, also not our friend. North Korea, not our friend. China, what are you doing?
I think this is, you know, to bring this back to directly linking it to education, you know, young people on social media are getting influenced by those bad faith international actors, you know, and you can see it.
I'm seeing it.
Seeing it bubbling up where, you know, young people go, oh, maybe Vladimir Putin is the good guy.
He's the good guy.
This is why we need to fund to the proper level all public schools. You know, we're talking about over 4 million Australian public school students who are underfunded. 4 million. We're talking about 98% of our public schools being underfunded. If I said to you there are 4 million Australians who cannot access healthcare, there are 98% of our hospitals do not have the resources they need to provide the basic standard of care, you just wouldn't believe it.
Say it was a system under pressure. You would say that even if outcomes are presently good, it's unsustainable. You would have concerns about the future of the system. That's rad. We know that there is a generational teacher burnout horizon if resources are not met to the student resourcing standard. And I really, really hope that the legacy for this Labor government is the education revolution we deserve. You know, the education curve. And I just want to put this out there as a political offering to the Australian people. The idea anyone in the parliament would vote against increasing resources for state schools that educate the overwhelming majority of Australian children.
Yeah.
Like, put your hand up, Peter Dutton, if you really say, well, you know, 65% of the population can have less. Go on, do it, Pete. See how your aspirations and be prime minister go. Or if the Teals and Greens or anybody else wants to kick off about educational choice, which involves, you know, one community of like a priority getting more resources than the majority. Let's see how that goes down and decide.
And unfortunately, the majority of private schools are currently overfunded, according to the school resourcing standard amounts. You know, so there is a divide there. And like I said, I'm happy that 3 million Australians are going to get some help with their help debts. That's great. But not Australian will be eligible for that. And I know it is not just university students. There are people who have other forms of education debt from training that are going to get assistance as well. But we're talking here about the vast majority of everyday Australians who send their kids to public schools who are being shortchanged. Now, you know, all the commentary about record levels of funding or whatever that Morrison, the lie that the Liberals told for 10 years about every budget, it was a new record. You know, that was just inflation. That was literally just inflation and indexation. Never closed the gap. In fact, they've made it worse a decade. And look, these programs, these, I don't want to call them piecemeal because I don't think they are. I hope they're indicative of Labor's commitment to getting the whole system, you know, from cradle to grave, right. You know, the investment in early childhood education, you know, has been game changer for so many families. We're seeing these in help, in these study hubs, in, you know, 655,000 fee-free TAFEs over the last two years of Labor government. Now, that's huge. These are game changers. But there are still 4 million Australian kids who are not getting the resources. The knock-on effects of which are hard to tell.
And the teachers who are being exhausted and exploited maintaining those standards from individual energy. And that's what we have to address within the system. Australian public schools are amazing.
Yeah.
And they perform incredibly for the disparity in funding that's been structuralized.
But
based on teacher exploitation.
And we shouldn't build into the system that our teachers will do more anyway, so we won't fund it properly. That's not a sustainable system. Not a Labor value. In fact, that's an antithesis of a Labor.
And we want more staff in schools. We want more support staff, and we want more specialised staff. And we want there to be facilities that can enfranchise engagements with social and special needs support. All of these things.
Article recently in The Guardian that talked about $1 billion shortfall in resourcing for students with a disability. And principals, only 11% of principals feeling they had the resources to give a proper education to students with a disability in their school. Now that is shameful when we are spending so much, which we need to do, which the NDIS is so vital for people to participate in our society, to be active participants in our Commonwealth, to, you know, be active participants in our labour market, all those things. But then when they're in school, they're not get support because we've decided we're going to rely on ex-teachers and the goodwill and basically take advantage of the goodwill of teachers and their calling to our kids. Now, hopefully this will be the education we have to have. You know, the Australian Education Union, Principals Association, and we've seen state government ministers come out, everybody calling for this problem to be fixed. Go check out foreverychild.au. There's a campaign there you can support. You know, it's everywhere around the country. You know, you can see it on our social media, For Every Child. There are so many advantages to fixing this problem, for everything from making sure that kids who are in dangerous situations at home get the interventions they need earlier, right through to making sure that kids who may well come up with the next medical breakthrough get the support they need to do maths and science, to finding the next
or music or drug.
Yeah, finding the next Mozart or
when the money gets pulled out of those systems. You know, like, these are the kind of programs that you lose.
Yeah, you know, we
the industries of the entertainment industries of this future, all of these things relevant.
Yeah, yeah.
We want to have a system that serves everyone.
Yeah. So look, check out that camp. Hopefully, you know, we'll obviously do a special episode on the budget because that's the sort of thing we do here at The Week on Wednesday.
I'm sorry I sound so angry and upset. But talking about the against women and children issue, obviously, is really destabilizing.
People understand that. I understand that. I also just quickly want to give a shout out to our comrades in Queensland. It's Queensland Labor Day. I often call it Union Christmas.
Literally the most fun you will have is May Day in Queensland. If you share our values, if you're a tip-top union person and just love of being with your new community, make it a point, make it a bucket list item to go to the March and the May Day dinner in Queensland. It is the absolute highlight of the union calendar.
And if you're not a union member, and say particularly in Queensland, you'll be missing out. Join your union, australianunions.org.au/wow. It's just phenomenal. You'll see some of the pictures on our social media. And there is a good news story. We've conversed a lot of information today, but the good news story is about solar batteries.
I love solar batteries. I'm so pro.
So Collie, which people think of as a big coal power station area,
is in Western Australia,
is just absolutely diving in to battery power. There's going to be a new battery, which is going to add 341 megawatts or 1,363 hours to a coal facility, which already has 219 megawatts and 870 megawatt hours. These are being built by a French renewable energy and storage company using Tesla Megapack batteries and being done by UGL. Now, all in all, this means that Collie battery is just huge, 560 megawatts, 2,240 megawatt hours. It will be the biggest in Australia. Bigger than Synergy's 500 megawatt battery, which is also in Collie, by the way. And here's the point. These two batteries in Collie, the Synergy one and the French Neon, I'm sure I'm saying that wrong. My French is not my first language, obviously, or second or any language that I speak.
Terrible.
That means that they'll be able to provide 40% of the energy required for Western Australia's south connected system.
Which is, of course, the biggest power grid system in WA.
Yeah.
So 40% is coming from Collie, you know, which is a town that could have been frightened out of climate action by the implications for local industry, transitioning from fossil. But this is the thing, you can bring your community with you. This is why renewables are the best. This is why nuclear policy is so less, because renewables create diversified industrial opportunities. You know, there can be local employers, can draw international investment, can breathe life into the, you know, resource economy towns. This is absolutely fantastic. And thank you to everybody who done this, because it takes community faith as well to make infrastructure projects happen.
Yeah, absolutely. And up and running when the coal mines close, so there will be jobs from day one. And that's a huge thing. It's a huge thing. It's good environment. It's good for the community. And it means overall power prices will come down. There was a couple of days in summer where many of Australia's energy markets, the price of electricity was negative, you know, and Queensland, which is the world's leader in terms of rooftop solar, is giving $1,000 back every single person because they own their own system. They've invested in renewable energy. They've got rooftop solar everywhere, and they've gone, you know what, rather than us keeping the money back to the people who own the power system. There is so many good stories that can be told about energy. All we hear often from mainstream media is this fight the Tories want to have. They want to have these sort of never fights, these ongoing culture war fights. Well, here's some real news. 40% of WA's largest energy grid is going to be coming from batteries in Collie plants, the largest coal power station area, third way possibly in country, I think, at one stage.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. And I mean, the great thing is Ben and I had a number of Happy Men stories that we talked about today. Like, we're on all of these list stories, and there are solar cars going into production designed by Dutch students happening in the United States. In France, they're building solar cities.
Yeah, right.
Because cemeteries, of course, have open spaces.
Mm-hmm.
And they had some issue with water, and they were putting in a drainage system, and they were like, well, why don't we put solar roofs over the cemetery, which is also better for people visiting the cemetery. Like incredible things are happening all the time.
And I want to give a shout out to Daniel Conway, who's one of our supporters, who sends us these good news stories a lot and has provided us. I've been so unwell. We now have a backlog of some of these, but we wanted to get this collie one out. And of course, Daniel is not our supporter. The podcast is free to listen to, free to download, but we do promote it to people in Australia, obviously, and sometimes people around the world hear it. And we make no money out of this. This is not a profit driven act for us. Quite the opposite. So supporters who chip in $1 a week, $10 a month, or $20 a month, they're our $1 a week, extend the reach of supporters. That money all goes into getting the show into more ears, on more platforms, in front of more people, and they really help grow our list and get these messages out to more people.
And broaden the conversation as much from our engaged listener base as we hope we give back to them, if not more.
So to as they're congratulating our Extend the Reach and cadre for helping make this podcast happen, Ben is going to read out their names right now.
Michael Lewis, Elizabeth Walsh, Brittany Slapp, Riley C, Sue Schlesinger, Jessica Davey, 26, Jason Ichisaurus, Atrazis, Murray Budwell, Ms. Deanne Weir, Shamila Lachal, Labour Academy Victoria, Anne Coleman, Jeremy Moe, Ross Kenner, 888, Brom Terry Butler, Gail Ferguson, Rosie Elliott, Lara, Rebecca Fanning for Longman, Joe Lockery, Ellie Vance, Mary Lagoya, Sanj Kelly, love your work. Yeet Yeti, Claire, Donald Vaughan, Shane Horsfall, Damien Marley, Jason Dallas, Camille, Steffo, Cameron Strauss, Trout Dragon, Gay Kramer, Stephen Aiken, Trish Corey, Marky Mark, Daniel Crazy, John DeHaan, Greg Miller, Kathy Birch, Fiona McNeil, Karina Bali, Melanie Dinning, Penelope Judge, Jed Carnums, Adrian Valente, Bronman, Punch Drunk Veteran, Jenny Forster 7, Sharon Kelly, Jane C. Campbell, Mesritza at Carriedale 68, Richard Graver, Frank Nahouse, Vita W, Cassandra Tui, In Hampson, No Twitter for Me, Hannah Honda, Matt Bush, No Relation, Nandita Hannum, Brash Daniels, Maria Louise Hawker, Megan Weckett, Erica Pizzuti, Kylie Phillips, Graham Oxley, Tracy Lucas, someone, Leanne Shinks, Gail Vest, Greg Mutton, Amy Fawcett, not on Twitter, Sreenesh 20, Elian and Andrew, Billy Three McCabe, Ivis Billo, Narissa Simon, Peter O.C., Sam Hadid, Kibbers and Rachel Fitzpatrick, Lauren Ash and Banjo, Buncombe Bash and Stuart Munn. Katie Ward, Sandy Ballard, not Sandy B, John Sharp and Peter Bath, Louise Watson at Red Blue Lou. And I'm sorry about the pauses. We have a new, so it breaks our lovely database smaller chunks. And I absolutely hate it. But we'll be back to normal sooner rather than later.
Yeah. That is the Week on Wednesday for today, Monday, the day of May. You might get two episodes this week because we might even be able to do one on Wednesday. We'll have to wait and see. Thank you, everyone, with your patience.
And thank you for everybody who's Ben's health. We are absolutely as in the dark as anybody else with what's been ailing him, but we're doing our best to look after him.
Seeing the specialist again tomorrow, more doctor's appointments this week. Hopefully my voice for you this week. And until then, love you, Vanny.
Oh, I love you too. Bye.